iHeart Podcasts.
Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
So when I was in third grade, cable came into our neighborhood. And for one glorious summer, my parents got us cable TV. And of course, we abused the heck out of it. So I saw Spaceballs at least 20 times that summer. I watched all these old Disney classics on the Disney Channel. And best of all, we got Nickelodeon, which just transformed our neighborhood.
Oh, man, I watched so much Nickelodeon during the summers, but I'm curious for you, why did you feel like it transformed your summer?
I mean, this is when You Can't Do That on Television was on, and I just thought it was the funniest show in the world. It almost felt like it was written by kids for kids, but Double Dare was really what caught fire with the other kids in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know how TV worked, so we just assumed one day, like, Double Dare would come to town and they'd call us on the phone and we just have to be prepared for that moment. So every day, honestly, every day, we'd, like, quiz each other on trivia questions and then we'd, like, create these ridiculous physical challenges. We had a creek behind our house, so we'd get all muddy and, like, roam through it and we'd, like, climb trees and whatever we could come up with. And, you know, we practiced hard because we knew one day that call was going to come.
And it had to. So did it finally come for you?
I mean, of course not. But, you know, that hasn't reduced my enthusiasm for Nickelodeon. And today we're talking about everything from the channel's early history to how it became synonymous with slime to why it really got into the cartoon business. So let's dive in.
Hey there, podcast listeners. Welcome to Part-Time Genius. I'm Will Pearson, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend Mangesh Hattikader. And on the other side of the soundproof glass, wearing a spot-on recreation of Quail Man, you know, the Quail Man costume from Doug, of course. That's our friend and producer, Tristan McNeil. Now, you remember Quail Man, right, Mango?
Vaguely.
He was the kind of the imaginary superhero persona that Doug was always doodling in his little journal. You remember this.
So I like Doug, but I was really more of a Hey Arnold guy myself.
I'll be honest, I'm with you on that. But, you know, it's tough to choose a favorite from so many of the iconic shows from Nickelodeon. The network's golden age gave us so many memorable characters. In fact, I'm not sure if you knew this, but Nickelodeon's actually going through a bit of a resurgence right now. And that's thanks largely to the nostalgia that people feel for those early shows.
Yeah, it's funny to me because my son was at camp and while they were waiting at pickup, like they were all watching Rocko's Modern Life. And I couldn't believe it. It feels like a TV show that was so many generations ago.
Well, and actually, if you look at the Hollywood headlines from recent years, I mean, it's kind of crazy how many old Nick shows are currently set for revivals and reboots. So I was just making a list of these. You've got Hey Arnold, Rocko's Modern Life, Double Dare, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. Clarissa Explains It All. Are You Afraid of the Dark? Invader Zim, Ren and Stimpy, and the Wild Thornberries. I mean, the list just goes on and on.
Yeah, but it's got everything on there except Doug for some reason.
Yeah, but, you know, that is, of course, a notable omission. But maybe today's show will drum up some interest in a Doug comeback. And, you know, with Nickelodeon being back in the limelight, now feels like a pretty good time to take a closer look at the network's history and try to get a sense of what made those Nick shows so special in the first place. And also, I think we both just want to know how they got into the slime business to begin with.
That's right. But I do feel like we're getting a little ahead of ourselves because Nickelodeon wasn't always the network that slime built. In fact, in its earliest days, it wasn't even called Nickelodeon. Back in 1977, the network launched as Pinwheel, which was this low-budget channel aimed at preschoolers. And this was during the earliest days of cable TV. And then after 2 years of modest success, the network decided to expand its audience. And in that process is when it was rebranded as Nickelodeon.
Which is, I guess that word means kind of like an old movie theater, right?
Yeah, so I didn't actually realize that. Like a Nickelodeon was this pop-up small theater, and the name actually comes from a combination of the admission price, which was obviously just a nickel, and the Greek word for theater. Apparently, the first of these Nickelodeons opened in Pittsburgh, and this was way back in 1905, and then they popped up all over the country for the next 5 years or so, at least until the larger movie palaces began to replace them.
And it wasn't something I thought about as a kid. I didn't even know the word came from anything, but it does feel like a little bit of a weird name for a kids' network in hindsight.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, people in general tend to be a little confused about what the word really means. And that's partly because of a popular song from the late 40s. It includes the line, "Put another nickel in the Nickelodeon," which was, I guess, more of a coin-operated jukebox or music box or piano player. I don't know exactly what it was. But there's actually a third meaning to Nickelodeon, which refers to these old-timey movie picture viewers where you turn a crank and through, like, a viewfinder, you'd watch a short vaudeville act or something. And it's actually that last one that the network had in mind when they chose the name Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon's first logo was a cartoon mime looking into a viewer. I've never seen this before, but apparently it was shown as an interstitial between shows, and the mime would always turn the crank when the next program was about to start.
Yeah, and I can't imagine the mime logo stuck around for all that long, though, right? Like, it feels like a very outdated idea to even be using a mime in the first place.
Yeah, it really was. And the network changed logos a few times in those early years. Eventually, they settled on this big silver pinball with the name of the channel written in rainbow letters. And they stuck with that until the iconic orange splat logo hit the scene, and this was in 1984.
All right, so everybody can remember that one, or everybody that watched TV in this generation. So how did that come about exactly? Because it is this strange transition to go from mime to pinball to orange slime. I wouldn't say it's a very clear-cut progression.
Yeah, the slime actually debuted on the network's first hit show, You Can't Do That on Television, which we talked about earlier. The series had started abroad in 1979, but Nickelodeon did begin airing it until, I guess, 1981 in the U.S., and it featured both scripted and improvised skits with a few adults and a rotating cast of teen actors, or preteen actors, actually. Mm-hmm. And those were the first folks that were slimed by Nickelodeon.
So at that point, so slime was a recurring part of the sketches. I mean, I feel like that would be hard to write in over and over again.
So that's the thing. Apparently, the green slime was Roger Price's idea. He was the show's creator. And he came up with it as kind of a punishment for whenever one of the kids would say, "I don't know," during a sketch.
Right.
I'm sure you remember that was the code word to get slimed. And I always thought it was just like a fun joke. But the phrase really got on his nerves. And then Price also took to dumping water on the actors whenever they said water. But that was just because he thought it was funny.
I mean, it was pretty funny. It was always exciting as a kid to see this happening. And you, of course, would pretend to have these kinds of scenes at home where you'd say, "I don't know," and pretend to dump slime on each other. But it is funny that he came up with this idea just because the phrase got on his nerves. I mean, it doesn't really sound like the type of guy who should be working with kids.
Yeah, and I think the network was more or less aware of that because the show actually had this rule where no parents were allowed on set, and the kids weren't allowed to take scripts home with them either. But to be fair, when the cast started complaining about how frequently they were getting slimed and soaked, Price did start paying out bonuses of $25 or $50 for each sliming.
So these kids, every time they got slimed, they would get an extra payment. I mean, it feels like maybe they would just start saying, "I don't know," on purpose just to make an extra $50. But it also feels like a lot of effort just to keep the whole slime gag going.
I mean, it was kind of out of necessity. What's interesting is that You Can't Do That on Television was pretty much all the network had going for it at this point. And even that wasn't enough because by 1984, the channel had lost $4 million, and they routinely finished last in ratings among cable channels.
Wow. I mean, it's kind of surprising to look back because that was such a popular show that it's hard to remember that there was a time where they weren't doing that well. So how did they manage to turn things around?
So this is so strange, but the thing that actually turned it around was the slime, or at least, I guess, this like wild, messy attitude, you know, that slime represents. There was no other place on television where kids could see themselves acting up right alongside grown-ups or playing games, joking around, and, of course, making a huge mess as well. And people at the network took notice of this appeal. I mean, this sounds dumb, but that summer I was talking about, the reason we all loved Nickelodeon so much was that instead of being something dished out and given to kids, it actually felt inclusive, like kids were part of the process or something, and that it was created for you. And honestly, it's part of that spirit that we were trying to tap into, like, at Mental Floss. It was super playful without ever talking down, and everyone was welcome.
Except now I'm thinking we should have used more slime in the process. I mean, we missed this opportunity. But speaking of which, you were talking about the logo. So obviously, slime was the network surprise breakout star from that show. And I'm curious, is that where the Splat logo comes in?
Yeah, so with the channel struggling overall, the network president decided to hire a team to overhaul the Nickelodeon brand, and they decided to use slime as a jumping-off point. And the first thing to go was the pinball logo, and to replace it, there was this designer named Tom Corey. He came up with the familiar Splat logo. He actually saw this as something that was expressive and flexible. And Corey used two colors for the logo. He used orange and lime green, which basically became the network's go-to palette from then on. But the reason he chose those was because they're both international distress colors. So, of course, he hoped they'd command the same attention when they were on screen.
Okay. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And I do like his point about the flexibility of a logo like that. I mean, you know, Nickelodeon was using that pretty literally. When you remember watching the channel, you'd see all those, I guess, those bumpers between shows where that Splat logo would come onto the screen like a sticker, and then it would reform into like a dog bone or a hat or a blimp or whatever it was. And it was just this fun way to communicate the kind of energy and imagination that you expect from a network like this.
Definitely. And another thing that came out of this rebranding effort was the network's association with doo-wop music. So I didn't remember this, but prior to 1985, Nickelodeon didn't have many original productions. And the only way to communicate that attitude and vibe of the network was through these 30-second on-air promotions. So they've got this flexible logo now that's super fun, but they also need an audio hook. And the folks there look, and then some research shows up that kids actually respond really well to doo-wop music. So that's what they went with. And a couple of animators were brought in, and pretty soon Nickelodeon commercial breaks were filled with these sneaker-wearing dinosaurs who just dance around to doo-wop.
It's weird because I know that's been so long, but I can remember this so vividly. But I'm curious, though, did it work?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. Within 6 months of rebranding, Nickelodeon had become the number one channel for children's programming, which was a title it actually held on to for decades, even in the face of all the new competition from Disney and Cartoon Network and wherever else.
I mean, 6 months, that is pretty remarkable. And especially when you remember that none of the Nicktoons existed at this point, right? I mean, the network had picked up some, I guess, some pre-existing cartoons to rebroadcast. There was the days where they even had Looney Tunes shorts on there, the Danger Mouse show from England. But you know, if you think about original cartoons like Rugrats and Doug, I mean, those are still a good ways off because we're still talking about the mid-80s at this point, right?
That's right. And most of the success Nickelodeon had prior to the 90s really was on the creativity of its ad bumpers and the appeal of slime.
Well, I do want to get to those Nicktoons of the 90s, but first, I think we have to talk about Double Dare. I mean, we just have to talk about Double Dare, as big of a part of our childhood as this was. And it was the first hit the network produced in-house. But even more importantly, Double Dare probably slimed more unsuspecting kids and parents than any other show in Nick history.
Well, I mean, you know I'm a huge Double Dare fan. I'm still waiting for that call. But before we dive in, let's take a quick break.
You're listening to Part-Time Genius, and we're talking all about Nickelodeon. Of course, this children's media empire built on, a sticky foundation of slime, you could say. And speaking of slime, I don't know about you, Mango, but one thing I've always wondered while watching Double Dare was what that goopy green stuff was actually made of. I mean, if you look online, there are a million different recipes for homemade slime with ingredients from, like, corn syrup to what my kids use of, you know, school glue, but I've always wanted to get my hands on the real deal, you know, like some of that professional slime, I guess you'd call it.
I mean, I can't speak for the slime on Double Dare, but I can tell you that you definitely don't want to recreate the first slime to appear on Nickelodeon.
And why is that?
Apparently, the initial batch of slime for You Can't Do That on Television was just a mix of green latex paint and leftover food scraps from the studio cafeteria. It was disgusting. It was refined later to be this mix of cream of wheat, food coloring, and baby shampoo, which is also disgusting, but way better for all the show's slime dumping needs. And while it's still gross, you know, it's definitely better than straight up garbage.
You know, all I remember of cream of wheat when I used to eat it as a kid were how tiny those boxes were. So now I'm imagining them having to get like thousands and thousands of tiny cream of wheat boxes just to make this slime. But, you know, if you think about it, if nothing else, it's interesting to trace this evolution of slime across the different shows. Like I was reading about some of the ingredients that they'd used over the years. I read cottage cheese and vegetable oil were also a key ingredient at one point. And, you know, to come back to the idea of Double Dare, the host, Mark Summers, he claims the show's slime was made from vanilla pudding, applesauce, oatmeal, green food coloring, and by the third day, anything else that was on the obstacle course.
Yuck. So do they really reuse the same batch across multiple days, though?
Yes. And bear in mind, when the show was at peak production, they were taping like 6 or 7 episodes a day. So, you know, imagine these kids schlepping through these messy obstacle courses covered in that same week-old applesauce as, you know, the last contestant had. And actually, I came across a pretty funny story about it in this interview with the show's announcer. His name was John Harvey. And here's what he said. You know that tank we filled with styrofoam peanuts or balloons or sometimes water in the obstacle course? It was pretty long, 15 or 20 feet, and we'd fill it with various crap. One time we filled it like, I don't know, a third of the way up with baked beans. When you empty that many baked beans into a tank, you want to get your money's worth. So we shot a week's worth of shows with baked beans. At the end of the week, shooting day in and day out under hot lights, it was pretty ripe.
So, I mean, you can just imagine how gross that'd be with all the studio lights just baking all that squishy food beneath it. And, you know, I feel bad for the contestants, but also just think about the poor stagehand whose job it was to empty the tank at the end of the week. That just feels so gross.
Yeah, I feel way worse for that person than I would any of the kids, because you know the kids loved it, no matter how bad it smelled. The worse it smelled, the more excited they were. But I am glad that you mentioned this, because Robin Russo was actually the long-suffering stage assistant who had to deal with this kind of thing and come up with ways to clean up after these huge messes. And according to her, they actually called in one of those big vacuum trucks. Those are the ones that are nicknamed honey wagons. Huh. And it's what people use to empty things like septic tanks and porta potties. And apparently when the technician had finished sucking out all those baked beans that we were talking about, you know, sucking those through a giant hose, what he said to the crew was, he said it was by far the most disgusting thing he'd ever had to do.
Which is probably the highest praise you can get on a super gross kids game show.
Totally.
I am curious, though, like, did you get a sense for how Double Dare happened in the first place? Like, I know the network had a slew of game show hits after it in the 90s, but Double Dare really felt so different from anything before it on TV.
Yeah, it was very different than anything you'd seen before. So game shows were never really a staple of children's programming in the same way that cartoons or variety shows were. And in fact, the reason Nickelodeon decided to try one of these out, it actually had more to do with corporate sponsorship than anything else. So in the mid-80s, the network was approached by a production group that had already signed Nabisco on as a sponsor. And so apparently the game show slant was really more Nabisco's idea. Hmm. And so as a cookie and snack company, you know, they didn't have any characters or toys to promote through animated pieces. So they figured that a game show might actually be a better way to get their brands on kids' TV.
So did Nabisco come up with the whole format too? Like this idea of mixing trivia questions with crazy physical challenges and all those obstacle courses?
No, I mean, that all really came from the show's producers. They happen to be big fans of the board game Mousetrap and also of Rube Goldberg machines. And actually, that was basically the premise that kicked the whole thing off. You know, one of them said, wouldn't it be fun if you made a Rube Goldberg machine, but instead of a ball, it was a person?
I mean, the other thing that's so associated with Double Dare to me is Mark Summers.
Definitely.
Because, I don't know, he just seems like one of those guys who was born to be a game show host. And obviously, I mean that in the best possible way.
Oh, absolutely. And I think he would say the same thing. I mean, the guy had been a huge game show fan his whole life.
Huh.
His first job in LA was actually working on Bob Barker's old show that was called Truth or Consequences. Plus, the guy is even a member of the Stage Magicians League. So, you know, he was definitely a performer who knew how to build this connection with the audience and, you know, knew how to keep a show moving along. But you know, when we're talking about him, there is one aspect of Summer's background that didn't gel so much with Double Dare.
I'm guessing you're talking about his OCD.
That is exactly what I'm referring to. And the irony of someone with that condition hosting probably the messiest game show in the world wasn't lost on the host. In fact, in a 1997 interview that he did with Oprah, Summer said of the experience, it was like a bad sitcom. There I was hosting a television show where people were throwing green buckets of goo on each other. And I was having a good time, but you take what was going on in that show and multiply it. If you watch the first 65 episodes, I never got a drop on me. The kids would be over there just consumed in whipped cream and chocolate, and I'd be over here. And at some point, the producers came to me and said, you know, you really do have to participate as much as possible. And to Mark Summers' credit, he totally did after that. In fact, I don't think Mark Summers ever let his aversion to messiness interfere with the fun of the show.
Which is probably a big part of the reason he was brought back to host later incarnations of the show. And even though he ceded his hosting duties for the 2018 version of Double Dare, he'll still be there for every episode as the new announcer.
You know, I do like that every time it gets brought back, we can always depend on those two constants, Slime and Mark Summers.
And a giant prop nose for kids to dig flags out of. That's pretty important,
totally.
Too. So I know we're both excited to talk about the dawn of Nicktoons in the early 90s. But before we do, I actually want to take us on one more quick tangent about Slime, and in particular, toy Slime.
Okay.
So, of course, in the 90s, Mattel and Nickelodeon teamed up for their own line of Nick-branded slime, and they made a bundle off it because the slime later spawned this whole line of sticky goops with ridiculous-sounding names. You've got Gak, Floam, Smud, Zazand, which I'd never heard of, but it has two Z's at the start of it for maximum wackiness, I guess.
I feel like you made up most of those names, but I do remember Gak, which was... It was not only gross looking, but it also made this weird like farting noise when you squeezed it into the container. So, of course, this was a hit with all the kids. But you know what's kind of messed up about this name? The name Gak actually comes from a slang term for heroin. Did you know this?
I mean, I didn't know that, but I assume that's coincidental.
Yeah, well, apparently the Rowdy Double Dare crew gave it the nickname and somehow sneaked it by the network censors.
That's crazy. So obviously we're familiar with some of the slime toys that came out more recently, but I wanted to take a sec to tell you about what's considered the first toy slime as we know today, and that's Flubber, or flying rubber.
Yes, and of course we remember this from the Absent-Minded Professor movies, and so they made a toy version of it, right?
Yeah, in 1963, Disney partnered with Hasbro to make something that was supposed to be just as stretchy and bouncy as the on-screen counterpart. Obviously, that's impossible. But the whole thing was a disaster. It bounced and it stretched, but it also caused folliculitis, which I guess is this infection of the hair follicles. So right after the toy hit shelves, there were all these cases of kids getting sick with fevers and sore throats and these full-body rashes, and it was horrible. But that's not even the worst part. So the company pulls the product from shelves, and it's at least a decade before another toy company even attempts to sell another toy slime again.
So I guess you could say Flubber tainted the good name of slime for an entire generation. I mean, that is just so sad. But I'm really curious, like, what do you do with all that extra slime? Do they just send it off to the landfill?
So that's actually my favorite part of the story. Hasbro tried to incinerate the stuff. But rather than burning up, the slime just smoldered and let off this toxic black smoke. So then they got the Coast Guard involved to help them sink the stuff in the ocean. But then it floated back up to the surface again and they had to try something else. And in the end, the company just buried all the remaining tons of unsold flubber and then they paved over it to make a parking lot for the new warehouse in Rhode Island. And it's still in use today.
Oh, my gosh. All right, well, that was a pretty good tangent, but I think it's finally time for us to talk Nicktoons.
Absolutely, but first let's take a quick break. Okay, well, so this is going to sound weird, but I have to tell you just one more thing about toy slime. And you've got to bear with me because I promise this part ties in perfectly to the creation of those Nicktoons you wanted to talk about.
All right, well, I'm curious to see how you pull this off, so go ahead.
Okay, so in the 1980s, the state of toy slime was looking grim again. And rather than being sold on its own merits, like in the glory days of the 70s, toy slime was now stuck playing second fiddle to other toys. So if you think about it, instead of like buying a little tub of generic slime and pretending it was toxic waste, you'd buy a He-Man playset that oozed slime into a pit, or maybe you'd have like a Ghostbusters figure that came with some ectoplasm. And obviously the slime had to make sense for the toy, but it's interesting that slime was no longer kind of a big enough draw on its own, and it had to have some kind of franchise pinned to it.
I mean, I guess that's kind of sad, but I'm curious, what's the connection with Nicktoons?
Right, so I'm getting to that. You might remember this, but back in the 80s, Reagan rolled back the regulations about marketing to children, and that basically opened the floodgates for all kinds of programming based directly on toys and games. And this had never been allowed previously. In fact, the shift was so dramatic that between 1984 and 1985, cartoons that featured licensed characters increased on TV by about 300%.
Oh, wow. All right. So you're saying that just like with toy slime, you couldn't just have a toy unless it was attached to some sort of like a cartoon character or something.
Yeah, that definitely helped, and the market started going that way. But it was the other way for cartoon companies, too. Like you wouldn't commission a cartoon unless you could build a toy franchise off of it. And that's exactly why Nickelodeon shied away from making their own original cartoons during the 80s. Like, they just didn't have the cash to invest in animation without the money to also produce a toy line to help make it profitable.
All right, well, so then what changed?
Well, basically, this woman named Vanessa Coffey showed up at the studio in 1988, and she started pushing the network to bring back original cartoons. She'd worked in development at Marvel for nearly a decade at that point, and she was doing toy line tie-in shows. This was like Transformers or G.I. Joe. And for a while, she was feeling pretty burnt out and worried that she might be over animation entirely. But then it hit her, like, she still loved telling stories through animation. She just hated feeling like all she was doing was making toy commercials.
And so what was Coffey's role on the Nicktoons?
She got her start with Nickelodeon by producing their animated Thanksgiving special. And after that, they hired her as a consultant to hunt down original ideas for potential shows. And the network still wasn't sold on the idea of, like, making their own cartoons, but they were curious to see what Coffey could come up with. And she was eager to show them, too. And she later said of the experience, quote, "It's not even what Nick needed. I felt like it's what kids needed. I felt like kids were being sold toys on television, and there was no emotional depth to anything. It felt like there was no substance."
I mean, I do kind of like that this, it feels like this was actually a labor of love for her.
Mm-hmm. She was basically a one-woman animation department. She was meeting with creators, scouring literary scene for, like, promising stories. And then once the execs actually saw the pilot she'd been testing, they made her vice president of animation on the spot. It's kind of amazing. And
yeah.
Her very first task was to fill a 90-minute time slot with three cartoons. And the series were all supposed to debut in August of 1991.
And it's pretty amazing when you see that, you know, those Nicktoons are all legendary, like Rugrats, Doug, Ren and Stimpy. I mean, she was 3 for 3 right out of the gate.
What's also interesting is that the shows are rooted in such totally different concepts, and it turns out that was completely by design. Vanessa Coffey set out to find shows that would form what she referred to as a balanced meal. So just listen to her describe how she put that initial block of programming together. Quote, "What's really good for you would be Doug. That's kind of the broccoli. That was going to be the emotional, psychological meal. And then I wanted to have a show that was spaghetti and meatballs. That's Rugrats. It's really fun to eat, and you get something out of it. But it's not like vegetables. It's spaghetti and meatballs. And then I wanted dessert. That's Ren and Stimpy, which has no actual value, and there's absolutely nothing good for you in it. It's just sugar."
I mean, I do kind of love that. I'm not sure that most people would recognize this as broccoli, spaghetti, meatballs, and pure sugar. I don't know how much of a balanced meal it actually is. But, I mean, it does make a lot of sense, and it seems so smart in retrospect. And, you know, going back to how distinct these shows were, it's not just that they were different from each other. I mean, they were unlike anything else on TV at the time. I mean, you know, not only did they lack that, you know, kind of comic book approach and a toy line or anything like that, but the characters they focused on were completely different. I mean, there was no crime fighting or warring aliens or robot invaders. And instead, you just had ordinary kids. I mean, these were characters the viewers could actually, I don't know, kind of see themselves in.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And so many cartoons are just about pure escapism. And don't get me wrong, I think that should always have a place at the table. But those early Nicktoons seem to offer something so much more substantial. Like Doug, for instance, is about a quiet kid moving to a new town, and he's dealing with stuff like bullies and school crushes and Rugrats. Like that's just a group of toddlers learning to navigate a world where everything is strange and confusing and so much bigger than them. And I don't know. I mean, like, everyone should be able to relate to that.
Yeah, and granted, that's not exactly true of Ren and Stimpy, but even there, the show's irreverence and just kind of that general anarchist attitude, it certainly captured a lot of what it feels like to be a kid. And the other thing I liked about Ren and Stimpy was when they'd parody those TV commercials and other real-world stuff that kids were probably just starting to get familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you remember they'd do those interstitial commercials in the middle of an episode, and then this announcer would come on and try to sell you a great new product called Log, and it was literally just a log, but it was pitched as this kind of like this landmark new product that everybody wanted.
So I loved Log, and I think I was in seventh grade when that came out, and I remember we'd always use Log as the name you entered at the bowling alley because it was three initials long, you know, and you just felt clever for referencing it. But I do know what you mean about introducing the world of adults to kids while also, I guess, taking it down a peg. You know, like even on Doug, which is kind of the most straight-laced of the Nicktoons, you had Doug's neighbor, Mr. Dink, who was just completely obsessed with keeping up appearances. And he was always showing off the latest, like, very expensive gadget he'd acquired. I mean, that's a pretty clever lampooning of real-life dads everywhere. But what's sad to me is that I've read that things are more committee-driven at Nickelodeon now, which is an approach that I guess is more in line with what the other channels are doing, you know, if you think about like Disney or Cartoon Network. And while it's definitely a safer approach for shareholders, from a creative standpoint, it feels like a step backwards from when Vanessa was at the helm, right? Like,
yeah.
I think part of what made her approach so special was that she insisted on working directly with content creators. Like, none of those shows we talked about were fully formed ideas when she first came across them. In every case, Coffee worked closely with the creators to develop something original and original characters and stories that would feel fresh to kids and also capture something that was true about their experience. And that's just so different from what networks are doing now. Like, I think Nickelodeon just bought the rights to Ninja Turtles a few years back.
Yeah, and, you know, it's kind of a bummer to see them embracing the toy commercial mentality that they really helped buck just a couple decades ago.
I know, but if it's any consolation, Hey Arnold already had its revival last year in the form of a new TV movie, and it went over really well with fans. The original creator and writers came back, and even a few cast members. So If they stick to that approach, there's a good shot of more classic shows stepping into the 21st century unscathed.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed on that. And just because I know the Doug revival is bound to happen sooner or later, I did want to read this quote from an Atlantic article on the impact of those early Nicktoons. So if any Nickelodeon producers are listening, here's something to keep in mind for that Doug reboot. And this is compliments of a writer named Spencer Kornhaber. So here's what he writes. Today, Doug stands as the purest distillation of Nickelodeon's simple, soulful interest in the inner lives of kids. Like the rest of his generation, Doug Funny wanted to be different, but wasn't. He wished his massive nose was smaller. He wished he could dance. He wished he were smarter. The show constantly portrayed the false relationship between becoming a better person and becoming a different person. It grappled again and again with the devastating epiphany of adolescence, that there are things about you that you just can't change.
I mean, I feel like I'm still coming to terms with all those things. Like, I've got a big nose. I wish I could dance. I wish I was smarter. But kudos to Doug to figuring out all that stuff so soon and also for helping so many other kids figure it out.
Yeah, but you dance so well with your nose. It's just really impressive. All right. Well, now I feel like we've had our broccoli, and I think it's time that we skip straight to dessert and have ourselves a little fact off. What do you think?
I mean, that sounds great to me. You know, Tristan's actually been collecting scraps from the staff kitchen all week for a bucket of slime. And what do you say the loser gets soaked?
I don't know. I have a couple things in common with Mark Summers, but but I'm feeling pretty confident. So let's give it a shot. So did you know that Suzanne Collins, the author of The Hunger Games, she actually started out writing for a slightly less dark show, Clarissa Explains It All?
That's pretty amazing. Actually, I found a fact about Clarissa that's great. There was a weird rule on the set that no one could use purple. And this comes from Slimed, which is a book about Nickelodeon history. And it was really a big deal. So Mitchell Kriegman, who created and produced the series, didn't want it on his set or in his office or anywhere. He didn't even want people wearing it to set. But the funny thing is, he actually didn't have anything against the color purple. And this is what he told Slimed. Quote, Clarissa is the first big show I ever ran. And I had this advice from an old pro in the business who said, the first thing you do when you go down there, come up with something arbitrary that everyone's got to do and stick to it and never explain it. But apparently people did, you know, realize the humor in it and they tried to sneak it onto the show a few times just for fun.
That's a pretty great rule. All right, well, here's a funny thing about slime. In 1984, the creators of Ghostbusters actually threatened to sue Roger Price. You remember, he was the guy we were talking about who started You Can't Do That on television. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to sue him for stealing their idea for green slime. But the suit was eventually dropped once they found out that Price had been sliming kids for a good 5 or 6 years by that point. I don't know if he was just randomly sliming kids or what this was, but if anything, they might have actually taken the idea from him.
So speaking of slime, did you know there's a slime ketchup on the market right now?
Oh, no.
It's this thicker, gross, green stuff called slime sauce, and Nickelodeon and Walmart combined together to put it out. It costs about $2.50 a bottle.
I think that's one idea I'm going to pass on, but that's pretty funny that it exists. All right, well, it turns out the Rugrats creators were actually the ones behind the Simpsons' yellow skin and Marge's blue hair.
Really?
So before Arlene Klasky and Gabor Supo worked on Rugrats, they actually helped animate the Simpsons.
That's pretty awesome. So I actually have a Simpsons fact, too. And apparently the creator of Hey Arnold is Matt Groening, who's the Simpsons creator. He's his brother-in-law. And one bit of advice he gave him was design characters so that they can be recognized from a distance or in silhouettes. And that's actually why Arnold has such a distinctive football head.
Huh. That's pretty good. All right. Well, here's a fun one. John Kay, who designed Ren and Stimpy, got the idea after seeing a picture of a chihuahua in a sweater. You know, we're always inspired when we see pictures of chihuahua in sweaters. Well, here's what he said about it. He said, "It's a very funny picture because here's a psychotic looking monster in a cute sweater," which basically sums up Ren.
That's pretty funny. So here's one about Doug. Did you know he was almost called Brian? Apparently the creator thought the name was too fancy, so he, quote, geared it down and called him Doug because it sounded, quote, incredibly average.
I like that the name Brian just sounds too, like, sophisticated fancy or something. Yeah, Fancy Pants Brian. That's pretty good. I will say I love the idea of starting our show with Tristan's tribute to Doug and ending with him, too. So I feel like we should leave it there, and I'm going to give you this week's Fact Off Trophy, Mango.
I can't wait. Thank you so much.
And I guess I'll have to get slime. This is a bummer. But before I do want to let our listeners know, we always love hearing fun facts from you guys. I know there's some great Nickelodeon stories and some great facts that we didn't share today. So we'd love to hear those from you. You can always email us parttimegenius@howstuffworks.com, or you can hit us up on Facebook or Twitter. But as always, thanks so much for listening. Thanks again for listening. Part-Time Genius is a production of How Stuff Works and wouldn't be possible without several brilliant people who do the important things we couldn't even begin to understand.
Tristan McNeil does the editing thing.
Noel Brown made the theme song and does the mixy-mixy sound thing.
Jerry Rowland does the exec producer thing.
Gabe Luzier is our lead researcher with support from the research army, including Austin Thompson, Nolan Brown, and Lucas Adams.
And Eves Jeffcoat gets the show to your ears. Good job, Eves.
If you like what you heard, we hope you'll subscribe. And if you really, really like what you've heard, maybe you could leave a good review for us.
Did we forget Jason?
Jason who?